Bienvenidos al podcast del Instituto Fe y Libertad. En este espacio conversamos con expertos y analizamos posturas sobre economía, religión, libertad y más.
Welcome to this edition of our podcast. Today we will be interviewing Jason Jewell. Professor Jewell chairs the Department of Humanities at Faulkner, a Christian university located in Montgomery, Alabama. He teaches and is an advocate for the Great Books Program and for the humanities. He received a PhD in humanities from Florida State University, a master's in history from Pepperdine University, a BA in history from and music from Harding University. So you are the humanities in person. He is associate editor of Journal of Faith and the Academy, and a member of the editorial board of two other academic journals. He has contributed to Christian Faith and Social Justice, Five Views, and The Inklings, and King Arthur. And he has contributed to six academic journals and five encyclopedias. His writings have also appeared in numerous magazines and popular journals. So today we will be talking about the various strains of conservative thought in the United States. So welcome, Dr.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you that for Guatemalans and other people, I think observing what is happening in academics and the public square in the United States, it's very confusing for us.
It's confusing for us too sometimes.
It's hard to follow who defends what positions. And so can we start by asking you, what is the definition of conservatism? And sort of start at the beginning.
Okay, well, that's actually a difficult question to answer because people who call themselves conservatives have argued over the definition for many years. The word was not used very often in the early part of the 20th century, but in 1953, a scholar named Russell Kirk published a book called The Conservative Mind, and he succeeded in bringing that word back into common usage. Before 1953, most scholars and politicians in the United States would have called themselves liberals of different kinds. But after 1953, many people began to call themselves conservative again. Well, Russell Kirk, when he used that word conservative, he meant someone who was interested in preserving the good things of the past. And he had this phrase, the permanent things, that he liked to use often, and said that a conservative was someone who wanted to preserve the permanent things, someone who believed that there is a transcendent moral order, that morality is not something that we invent ourselves, but it is something that is given to us from outside of ourselves. And he believed that private property was part of what it means to be a conservative. And he had a few other elements of his definition, but that became one that I would say most conservatives for most of the last 70 years would agree with to some extent. But other conservatives will argue about particular things, such as what should American foreign policy be, or what should be the role of the government in establishing moral norms for society, that sort of thing. So I would say that today, if you were to ask the man on the street what a conservative is, he would probably say someone who votes for the Republican Party in elections, someone who believes in God, someone who thinks that many of the things we see in formal education today have gone completely crazy. Mm. And so you would see a lot of those kinds of elements of a definition being offered by ordinary people, I would say. But you will always find, no matter what you say about conservatism, someone will disagree with you about it. That's the rule.
Okay. Well, I want to touch on some of the aspects that you just mentioned, but I wanted to tell you that in Latin America, I think we use the terms differently, and that contributes to the confusion, because traditionally here, liberals were people who defended Republican values. They were also very much in favor of economic and civic liberties and the notion of progress. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were anti-clerical and were responsible for trying to rid societies of the influence of the Catholic Church.
Right.
And on the other side, you had the conservatives who tended to defend colonial authority or colonial style authority, and also holding on to the status quo. So I think we have what to conserve is different, you know, in the different cultures.
I would say that the definitions that you've just given are closer to what you would see in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So a similarity there. But in the United States, the conservatives are usually the people who say that government should be smaller,
right,
and there should be more economic freedom. And today the conservatives are the ones who talk about civil liberties more. So it's very confusing for someone from a different context to come
yes.
in and see how the language is used. Going back to the early stages of what we usually call the conservative movement after World War II, there's sort of a partnership that comes. It's sometimes a difficult partnership. Sometimes there's a lot of arguing, but a partnership between the people who value tradition and value the past and the people who value individual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people in the American context, we more likely will call them libertarians if you value individual freedom. And the people who value tradition in the past, we'll sometimes call them traditionalists. But those are two groups that decided to make some kind of alliance in order to fight communism during the Cold War. And so they could agree at least on that much.
That's my third question, exactly.
Okay,
I was going to ask you about fusionism, because
okay.
I think that that's the term that was coined by Frank Meyer to justify this
yes.
union.
It's the he actually did not coin the term, but he put forward the ideas.
Okay.
And he believed that virtue, which the traditionalists valued very much, Frank Meyer argued that virtue could only truly exist in an environment of freedom, and that to exercise freedom in the proper way, one needed virtue. So he thought that those two were natural partners, and thus it made sense for traditionalists and libertarians to cooperate to try to advance both virtue and individual liberty. And so that was kind of the alliance that lasted within the conservative movement throughout the Cold War, at least up until the 1990s. And then once the threat of the Soviet Union was gone, they began to argue again. And some of the traditionalists believed that the libertarians were crazy, and some of the libertarians believed that the traditionalists were just didn't understand freedom, and they didn't understand economics, and so they've been arguing off and on ever since that time.
Okay, so so there's a splintering within the conservative movement. What are the discussions based on, you know, what is, like, for instance, the difference between a fusionist and a NatCon, and I don't know, there must be some other groups.
Yes, there are many different small factions within the conservative movement. Some of them are really just a handful of writers without any large base of support among ordinary people. But I think today the most obvious division is between the fusionists, who still consider themselves to be maybe the intellectual heirs of Ronald Reagan, the president of the United States in the 1980s. He pursued a more or less a fusionist strategy during his presidency, that emphasized things like free trade and not stressing too much on social questions. For example, President Reagan did not do much to try to overturn the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade about abortion. Social conservatives were not very happy with him about that, but you know, at that time they still thought the Soviet Union was the great threat, and so they were willing to put up with that. But the fusionists today still want to say that strategy that Reagan pursued is the best one for us today, and we should maintain a free market, you know, a free market economy to the greatest extent that we can, and we should continue to have free trade. And then we have the people who sometimes will call themselves the new right, but they also will have, sometimes the labels are given to them by other people, sometimes they take those labels on themselves, but you'll hear phrases like national conservatives or NatCons or Christian nationalists is one that's been discussed a lot in the last year or so. And these are the conservatives who believe that the fusionist strategy, maybe it was good during the Cold War, they might say, but in the 21st century, we are looking at a different set of problems that need a different set of policies to deal with. And so free trade is an obvious one where they disagree with the fusionists. The national conservatives will often say things like, we need an industrial policy to safeguard our national security. And also they think that by trying to have some kind of top-down management of the economy, favoring certain sectors in the economy, that this will lead more reliably to national prosperity. And the fusionists get very frustrated when they hear the national conservatives talk about that, because they think that all of these economic questions were settled 200 years ago with writers like Adam Smith. So they continue to argue about economics. That might be the most obvious division between the fusionists and the NatCons. But then they'll also argue about the role of religion in public life. The National Conservatives published a statement of principles on the website of the American Conservative magazine about a year and a half ago. This would have been in the autumn of 2022. And one of those principles was that the government should acknowledge the dominant religion of the country as a positive force and as supporting essential social norms and social cohesion. And so NatCons are very comfortable with things like political officials making public statements in favor of the Christian religion, for example. They might say, we've had court cases in the United States where local governments would perhaps put a nativity scene out on the courthouse lawn in December. And then some atheist will sue the city and say, that's an establishment of religion if you have a Jesus in the manger out there in December on public property. Well, there was a time in the late 20th century when federal courts would often agree with the atheists and say, yes, that is an establishment of religion. More recently, the Supreme Court has begun to overturn some of those cases and to say, no, that's not an establishment of religion if you simply have religious symbols on public property. And so national conservatives are very happy about that. They think there should be more public celebration of religious faith. And so they want to see government officials make that more visible. And that makes some of our secular friends very uncomfortable. So those are two, I would say, two of the major areas of very visible disagreement between fusionists and NatCons today.
And there's another term that's been in the air, which is integralism.
Yes.
What is that?
Okay, so integralists are a small group of thinkers and writers there's a larger group that is generally called post-liberals. The integralists are a subset of the post-liberals. But integralists are specifically Catholic writers and thinkers who, their ideal system is a confessional Catholic state. So in their perfect world, the government declares itself Catholic and acknowledges the Pope as a religious authority and endeavors to enact policy that is consistent with Catholic social teaching. So, as I said, this is a very small group of writers. The most, maybe the most well-known is a professor at Harvard University named Adrian Vermeule, and he has a number of followers and people who are supportive of him, and probably half a dozen intellectuals are really trying to write more and more about this ideal and to persuade younger intellectuals that this is desirable. I don't think that, I'll put it this way, I think the integralists have attracted much more attention from critics than they have actual influence.
Okay,
so that's a very small group, but they make a lot of noise. And there are a couple of long-standing conservative institutions that have become sympathetic to the integralists. And so I think it's possible that if they are able to establish themselves with some institutional support, then maybe 20, 30 years from now, if they have, you know, funding for a generation and they're able to spread these ideas, then maybe they would have a significant amount of support in certain quarters. But at the present moment, there, it's a very small group of writers. The post-liberals, as I said, are a larger group. And these are people that, in some respect, you might call the national conservatives post-liberals, since they think that fusionism is a failed strategy. And so they don't think that these principles of what we would call classical liberalism are likely to be successful. I think if I wanted to put the most favorable interpretation on their argument, it would be something like this, that classical liberalism is a good and healthy thing in the context of a firmly Christian culture and society, that it's good to have that kind of individual liberty to the greatest extent you can if you're confident that the culture is Christian and will support the people with that liberty will make the right kinds of choices. But in the year 2024, they would say we are not in a context of a Christian culture anymore. And so people with individual liberty to the maximum extent are much more likely to use that liberty in destructive ways. And so prudence demands that we have more restraints placed on people by the government. I think that's, if you were to ask national conservatives why they want to restrain individual liberty, you'd get an answer something like that.
So. what should be the role of religion, I think, in the conservative movement? What are, you've discussed on how some of the groups are more Christian than others or care more about cultural issues, but what should be the role of Christianity?
It's interesting, you know, not all conservatives are religious. Not all of them are Christians. We have many conservatives who would probably accept the label of cultural Christians if you were to press them. And that's, the cultural Christian will say that you know, Christianity, the teachings of Christianity have given us social norms and social ethics that are beneficial, and so the influence of Christianity has been very good, but they might not actually believe the doctrines of Christianity. So to that extent, I think most conservatives fall into one of those two groups. They are either confessional Christians themselves or they are cultural Christians. and acknowledge the beneficial effects of Christianity. So you don't often see conservatives protesting religion, which I think is good. I think that every society has some kind of religious foundation. It might be what Jean-Jacques Rousseau called a civil religion. But I think that every society has some kind of foundation of morality and norms that they are unwilling to question. And I also think that Christianity has provided us with the best set of norms. So for most of American history, the idea of, for example, a local government celebrating Christmas would have seemed very very obvious, mm-hmm. you know, to almost everyone. And it's only after World War II, let's say after, starting definitely in the 1950s and 1960s, that federal courts began trying to restrict those kinds of public observances of religion. So I'm trained as a historian, mm-hmm. and I think I have something of an understanding of the context, the religious context that gave rise to the American founding and the individual liberty that we enjoy. And so I don't see anything wrong with public celebration of Christian religious holidays and that sort of thing. I don't consider that to be an establishment of religion. And I think that if the majority of the population continues to call itself Christian, which we still do in the United States, that there's no problem there. Now, so that's symbolic, that's external kinds of pageantry and that sort of thing, no problem. Now, if you get to the point where you want to say, here is the Bible and the law of Moses, you know, says we should have these kinds of laws prohibiting this kind of behavior, then you're on a different kind of ground, I think, and you would have to make that kind of argument. In the pluralistic society that we have, you'd have to make that kind of argument from a basis of reason and shared values and not simply divine revelation. Mm-hmm. So I try to walk a little bit of a tightrope there, I guess, on what is the best expression of religion in public life. I certainly don't think religion should be barred from public mm-hmm. life, and that is where what we've had to some extent in the United States in the last 50 years, unfortunately. But as I said, recent Supreme Court cases have started to turn the tide on that, and we're starting to see more acknowledgement that, yes, America historically is a Christian country, and there's no problem with having religious symbols on public property and things of that sort. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you. What is the nature of the relationship between conservatives and the Republican Party?
Okay, so in the 1950s, when the conservative movement got underway, conservatives were a small minority within the Republican Party generally. But we also had a fair number of conservatives in the Democratic Party. We had the so-called Southern Democrats or Dixiecrats, who were very socially conservative in a number of ways. And so you could find a conservative presence in both major parties. Well, after the 1960s and the counterculture of the 1960s and the Vietnam protests and all of that, the conservatives gradually got pushed out of the Democratic Party. When I was young in the 1970s and 1980s, you could still find examples of Democrats holding high office, people in the U.S. Senate, for example, who called themselves pro-life and would vote against abortion and so on. But those people are long gone. No one in the Democratic Party, to my knowledge, on the national stage would call himself or herself a conservative in 2024. That means that the Republican Party has become the default political home of mm-hmm. conservatives over the last 50 years. Now, not all conservatives are members of the Republican Party, and there are factions of the Republican Party that are opposed to conservatives. We have the so-called Rockefeller Republicans from back in the middle of the 20th century who were liberal in their outlook. Today we have groups that call themselves things like the Log Cabin Republicans who don't like the conservatives. But I think the conservatives are the dominant force in the Republican Party right now. There are some conservatives who think that the Republican Party doesn't do what it ought to do, and so they'll favor, you know, tiny third party candidacies and maybe the Libertarian Party or the Constitution Party or some very small groups like that. But I would say that most of the time, if you ask someone who calls him a conservative, what party are you voting for, and they'll say Republican. So it's not a one-to-one relationship, but I think that at the current moment, the Republican Party is where most of the conservatives find themselves.
Okay.
Yes.
And this for us in America, there are foreign policy implications.
Yes.
And there are some people who are isolationists, and some people who think that the U.S. should be sort of like the umpire of democracy,
the policeman of the world, that sort of thing.
And and are more interventionist. And I don't know how conservatives feel about this debate.
This is an area where there has been a big change in the last 10 or 15 years. Of course, Ronald Reagan's foreign policy was very interventionist, and part of the Cold War strategy was to stop the Soviet Union wherever they were in the world, in Africa or Latin America or Southeast Asia. Beginning in the 1990s, more and more conservatives began to argue, the Cold War is over, we should become a normal country again. It's not our job to go tell everybody in the world what to do. But the Reagan, I guess we could call them the Reaganites, and the faction of conservatives that we usually call neoconservatives continued to favor a very active foreign policy. That group, I think, reached its peak of influence during the presidency of George W. Bush and the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And the neoconservatives who were urging that conflict appeared to believe that the United States would be able to turn Iraq into a modern democracy. Well, things didn't turn out that way, and the neoconservatives had a lot of egg on their face, as we say in the U.S. And so Bush's foreign policy became was widely seen as a failure, and that helped lead, of course, to the election of Barack Obama in 2008. And in the years since then, increasingly, the conservatives have argued for a more, quote-unquote, realistic foreign policy, one in which the United States is not going to try to be the dominant player in every region of the world. And these so-called realists will say things like, we think China is the big threat to world order now, and so the United States should focus its foreign policy priorities on trying to restrain China's influence. And these conservatives will argue that conflicts in the Middle East, such as between Israel and Palestine, or conflicts in Ukraine, are of lesser importance overall for the world. And so these conservatives who want a more restrained foreign policy found a voice in Donald Trump. Donald Trump in 2015 and 2016 was the first major Republican candidate to make an open challenge to the Ronald Reagan foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was elected in 2016, and he has the distinction of being the first president in, since the end of World War II, I believe the term is, that who didn't start a new war. So whatever else Donald Trump may have failed at, he has the distinction of not having started a new war for the United States. So that is where I think most conservatives are today. They want a more restrained foreign policy. Many of them still got talked into supporting Ukraine against Russia because anti-Russian feeling dies very hard in America after the Cold War. Memories are still there to some extent. But I think it is, you'll see now the more expansive language about foreign policy and trying to influence the world coming from Democrats. I think that today you will find more support for a very active foreign policy actually coming from Democrats. And this is often because of their social views. They will see American foreign policy as an opportunity to, for example, spread feminism to parts of the world.
A Wilsonian view.
Yes, or spread gay rights and gay marriage to other parts of the world. And, of course, conservatives have no interest in doing that. And so if that is the goal of U.S. foreign policy, the conservatives are saying we don't want any part of that. So that actually returns us to, I would say, a more traditional orientation of foreign policy between the two major American parties, because for most of the 20th century, it was the Democratic Party that was very actively bringing the United States into more world conflicts. World War I and World War II, the Korean War, those were all Democratic presidents that took the United States into those wars. And the activism, active foreign policy on the part of the Republican Party, I think was more of a historical aberration. And now we've returned more to, I guess I would say, a normal orientation of those two parties in foreign policy.
Okay, well, we'll see what's in store for Guatemala after the November election. But are you hopeful for the future?
You know, hope is a Christian virtue, and I am hopeful. I don't know that I'm optimistic, but I am hopeful. I think there are signs of encouraging things that are happening. We have a number of developments domestically in the United States where I think ordinary people have decided that some of the things that our political class has been doing for the last generation has just become too ridiculous. And so we see many things on the state level and on the local level in the United States that are very encouraging. Many states in the last 2 or 3 years have passed what we call school choice reform legislation, which will make it much easier for parents to give their children a Christian education. In some cases, they'll be able to use public funds for that. There are also some encouraging signs, on some other social fronts. Some of the most extreme of what we call the woke revolution of a couple of years ago, that seems to have quieted down some more as more and more resistance is being offered to it. And so I think there's a potential for an outbreak of sanity in our culture over the next few years. At least that's what I'm praying for.
Okay, well, we will join you in your prayers, Dr. Jewell. We have really only scratched the surface of these topics, but we are very, very grateful to you for illuminating us on the political scene and the conservative question in the United States. We thank you very, very much for being here in Guatemala and for sharing your knowledge with us.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you again for the invitation.
And for our viewers, if you need more information regarding Instituto Fe y Libertad, its work, activities, and what was discussed in this episode, you can visit feylibertad.org. Our sites on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, or our YouTube channel. Thank you very much for joining us.